time over there on one verse in chapter 5, verse 2. And I thought it was one of the best sermons I preached. The only bad thing about it was it didn't take on tape. So I guess if it was any good, those of you that heard it will enjoy it. But the rest of the people will never know whether it's any good or not, simply because we didn't get a tape that night. I don't know what happened, some sort of malfunction. But tonight we want to look at verse 8. And before we read the 8th verse, in order to get a better understanding of verse 8, I want us again to look at those questions in verse 6 and 7. Because what we have in verse 8 is the answer to all of these questions. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Now we have all those questions there in verse 6 and 7. And then we have the answer given in verse 8. Here's the answer. He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. We might really say that that 8th verse is almost a summation of all true religion. It's like a verse over in the last chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes that says, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. But there's quite a bit in that 8th verse, if we can only bring it out. I would say that this verse is about the Lord's requirements for his people. And really it's just one basic requirement, though it involves many other aspects, as we shall see. So there's the answer to the verses that have preceded. And he starts off by saying, he has showed thee, O man, what is good. Now, what does he mean there when he has showed thee? In other words, it's already been revealed. It's already been taught. It's already been set forth by Moses and even by the prophets what the Lord requires of his people. Now, in case you don't believe that that was the case, go back to Deuteronomy chapter 10 and look there at verse 12 and 13. And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee? But to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all of thy heart and with all of thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. You'll note the word good is used here. But here in Deuteronomy 10, it is said that this is to be done for the good of the people that do it. And over here in our text in Micah, we're told that it is good. In other words, it ought to be done because it is the right thing to do. So it is a good thing to do, and it is for the good of those that do it. By comparing the two verses together, we can see that. You'll note here that according to the Bible, there are some things that are good. That implies that there are other things that are evil. So the Bible speaks about the good and what we would call the bad. But what we're concerned with in this verse is not the bad. That's certainly been dealt with in verses before. But what this verse is concerned about is what is good. Now, if I were to ask you the question tonight, what is good? How would you answer that question? Well, this verse answers that question. God certainly does require some things of his people. And if you read the prophets and the law of Moses, you will see how that they reinforce the principles of righteous conduct and condemn mere formal worship. Whether you read the Old Testament or the New, God is not so much concerned about the letter as he is the spirit. They're both important. But it is the attitude you're in when you do it that is very important with God. That is even brought out in the book of Leviticus that we studied. Those offerings not only had to be brought according to the way that God prescribed them, but they had to be offered by a penitent sinner. They had to be offered with confession of sins committed against God. So I say the letter is important, but also the spirit in which the letter is carried out is equally important. So God requires not ritual so much as actual righteousness on the part of His people. He does not desire costly things like silver and gold and oil and even human sacrifice. But He desires the surrender of the heart to His service. And to Him that is first and foremost. And without this, all other things are worthless and mere vanity. Now the question is raised there, what doth the Lord require of thee? I say again, God requires some things of His people. These are demanded. These are commanded. They must not be slighted. They must not be ignored. God means what He says about them. He requires justice, mercy, and humility, to put it in a very simple manner. And really, these three things embrace the entire law of God that is given in the Bible. Now, let me show you what I mean by that. Turn over here to the book of Matthew, chapter 22. And you'll find that Jesus gives, well, the epitome or the summation of the entire law there in verse 34 to 40. But when the Pharisees had heard that He had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together. And one of them, which was a lawyer, asked Him a question, tempting Him and saying, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart and with all of thy soul and with all of thy mind. That's the first table, in essence. Now here's the second table. The second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So right there, in just a few words, Jesus Christ gave a summation of all that the law and the prophets taught. Essentially this, love God, love man. So if you want to summarize all that the Bible teaches in just a very brief statement, you can say that the Bible teaches that we are to love God and to love mankind. It will look like there ought to be a little more than that. No, that's a summation of all of it. And love will lead to the fulfilling of the law, as Paul brings out in Romans chapter 13. Love is a fulfilling of the law in that it'll lead a person to do right toward God and toward man. So that is a summation of the whole law. Now what God requires is justice, mercy, and humility. But Israel had been guilty of injustice, oppression, and lack of submission to God. In other words, He says, here's what God requires. You have done just the opposite. So they were in a terrible state. I mean, they had gone contrary to what God had said. They had acted in direct opposition to what the Lord would require of them. Now, if you look very carefully at these three requirements, there is one of them that is outward, another that is inward, and another that is upward. Now, did you get it? I'll go over it again. One of them is outward, the other one is inward, and the other one is upward. You say, well, I don't see that there. Well, let's see if I can show it to you. Let's start off with the one that is outward. That's the first of the threefold requirement. To do justly. Not only must we be a just person, but we must be just in our dealings with our fellow men in this world. Whenever the Bible speaks about a just man, it not only means a righteous man, but it means a man that does justly in the world. You may also be a man justified by his faith. That's another subject. But here, this is on human conduct. We are to do justly before our fellow man. Now, to do justly is not only to do what is just because it is just, but it is to do justice because God requires it of his people. There are a lot of people that are honest and just in their dealings because it's good business. I mean, a crooked businessman sooner or later will go out of business. It is just one of the laws of our economy that if you want to have satisfied customers, you've got to treat them right. Well, now, worldly people find that out. There are a lot of businessmen that are just as lost as a goat, but they have learned this basic principle. And they operate on the basis of it. Now, they're doing justly because it's right to do. But they're not doing it because God requires it of them. But the difference is here that we do it because God requires that we do justly. So I say the business world has learned the truth of that maybe better than some of God's own people. Because sometimes they'll treat you good, not because they fear God or believe the Bible, but because it's good for business. In other words, they'll put money in their back pocket. And that's why they do it. There's nothing wrong with what they're doing. I'm not condemning them for doing justly. The Bible requires that. But they ought to do it with respect to God. And that's what they're failing to do there. I think the Apostle Paul pretty well said this also in Romans 13 and 7 when he said, "Render therefore to all their dues." Could we kind of twist and turn that a little bit in modern English and say, treat everybody like they ought to be treated. Do the right thing toward everybody. I mean, that's about the way we would express it today, would we not? Do what God requires in that divine standard of righteousness. To put it simple, obey His moral law. And apart from the moral law of God, there is no morality in this world. I don't care what they say. I hear all these humanists. I hear these evolutionists say, "Oh, we have our standards." I heard one of them say it on TV in a debate. Because they were upbraided, because they didn't have any standard of right and wrong. They said, "Oh, we have our standards," but they never told what the standard was. The reason they didn't tell is because, in truth, they don't have one. Unless it's some sort of humanist manifesto, or maybe Mein Kampf, for all I know. I don't know what they may have. But they certainly don't believe the Bible, and they don't go by the Bible. And so they may do some things that are right, but they're not doing it for the right reason. And I think that's a terrible, terrible thing. The Bible tells us in Romans 7 and 12 that the law of God is holy, just, and good. There's nothing wrong with the law of God. If you do the moral law of God, you'll do well. Saint or sinner, it's good for anybody to live by. Be the best code that anybody could go by. Nothing wrong with the moral law of God. Brother John Gill gives his own summation of this verse. He says, "Hurt no man's person, property, or character." That's pretty good, too. "Do wrong to none, but do right to all." You know, the Bible is a very simple book. Oh, I know it contains some great theology, but when it comes to living a godly life, it's very simple in what it has to say. Just do right. I remember when I was a young boy, right after I married, I went to Southeastern Baptist College at Laurel. I may surprise you, I did go to college a little bit. But anyway, while I was down there, I remember that the man that was the president of the school called us all in the first day and said, "We just have one rule here at Southeastern Baptist College." And I thought, well, that'll be simple, just one rule to remember. He said, "Just do right." So that's the only rule we have. He said, "Just do right." Well, after I got thinking about it, I said, "Whoo, that's a pretty comprehensive rule, you know, when he said to do right." Well, what was he saying? He was no more than saying what is said here. The Lord requires that we do justly. That's what they were saying by that very simple rule. Social morality is inseparable from and rooted in the principles of true religion. And when you do away with the moral law of God and the religion of Jesus Christ, you don't have any right and wrong left. It's all chaos after that. You can take the law of our land. It's based on the civil law of Israel that Moses gave. And the Romans and the Greeks don't want to admit it, but theirs is pretty well based along the same lines. Read them and compare them with the Bible. That's all I tell you. You'll find out where they all came from. Because the Bible tells us how to do justly. Now, if you look back earlier in this book, you can see that Israel was just the opposite of what was required of them. Back there in chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it because it is in their power and their hand. And they covet fields and take them by violence. And houses and take them away. So they oppress a man in his house, even a man in his heritage. No wonder they needed to hear this sermon that was being preached here by the prophet. Then in chapter 3, if you go back and look at verse 2, who hate the good and love the evil, who pluck off their skin from off them and their flesh from off their bones. I guess to put it in a modern way of expressing it, those Jews were skinning one another alive in their business dealings. We used to have a saying out here in the country about some fellow skinning another one alive. We didn't mean that they literally did that like the American Indians sometimes. They literally did skin people alive. That was a part of their torment. But what it meant was that some fellow by fraud, some fellow by deception, had literally cleaned out a man financially some way by some crooked business practice. So we had the old saying that he had been skin alive in a business deal. So it meant about the same thing probably that Micah meant there. All right, we have looked at the one that is outward. Let us now look at the one that is inward, to love mercy. Now, it is one thing to show mercy. It is one thing to have mercy abounding in your heart. It is still a greater thing to love mercy. He didn't say be merciful. He said love mercy. That's the command. And really, I guess that's covenant loyalty that he's telling us about there. That is inward commitment to God's revelation that will manifest itself in a right relationship toward God and toward man. Mercy must not be stained. It must not be given grudgingly. But it must be loved. Mercy is to be a matter of the heart. And that is what he requires of his people. I know a lot of people that have mercy in their heart toward others. I know people that will be merciful toward those that maybe have treated them wrong. But I sometimes wonder if in their hearts they love mercy. You know, a person could be merciful in his heart and he could show mercy, but yet he may not love mercy, which is an attribute of God. So if you love mercy, you must love God because he's a God of mercy. And so essentially what he's saying here is be like God because God's just. God's merciful. So don't ever stain mercy. And I believe here that mercy includes forgiveness and compassion. I have known some people that would forgive, but they didn't have any compassion. But I believe that real mercy is not only forgiving those that offend you, but having mercy toward them in the sense that you have compassion upon them. You're sorry for them, that they are a sinner before God. And you love mercy. So I would say that there is a characteristic about mercy. It spreads its wings over the sinful and over the suffering. It has compassion and it has forgiveness. One fellow said that it was nobility's true badge. I know one thing, according to the Bible, it's God-like. The person that shows mercy knows the God of all mercy. Let me give you some illustrations of that. In the book of Proverbs 21:21, he that followeth after righteousness and mercy findeth life. Life at its best, the abundant life. Jesus spoke of in John 10. He that followeth after righteousness and mercy findeth life, righteousness, and honor. You want life at its best? You want righteousness? You want honor? Then follow after righteousness and mercy. The Bible says, surely goodness and mercy will follow us all the days of our life, and we'll dwell in the house of the Lord. That's certainly true. God's mercy will always go with us, but we need to be always showing that attribute of mercy that God has toward other people. And then I think about what Jesus taught there in the Sermon on the Mount. Very simple statement. The Lord was a very simple preacher. So, well, he is pretty profound sometimes, yes. But in the main, most all of his sermons could be understood by a child almost. Read them. I mean, it doesn't take a great theologian to understand Matthew 5 and 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. It sounds to me like there, if you want other people to be merciful towards you and you expect to have the mercy of God, you'd better be merciful. Well, what about a man maybe that don't have any mercy in his heart? Well, I think the Bible will tell you what will happen to a fellow like that. I thought of the verse this afternoon. Look in the book of James, chapter 2 and verse 13. Here's what's going to happen to the person that has no mercy. For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy. I thought a long time about that statement, judgment without mercy. Think about it, a just God dealing with a man according to his holy law and his holy attributes and showing him none of the attribute of mercy. I can't imagine anything any worse than that. I mean, that's horror of horrors. That's the tragedy of all tragedies, to have judgment without mercy. Do you know what a man has in hell? Judgment without mercy. Well, why don't God show mercy to them and bring them out? Because they're going to have judgment without mercy. It's the most horrible thought in the world, judgment without mercy. Well, I said that mercy was Godlike. I want to show you some of that. Go to the 6th chapter of Luke and look there beginning at verse 32. For if ye love them which love you, what thanks have ye? For sinners also love them that love them. And if you do good to them which do good to you, what thanks have ye? For sinners do even the same. And if ye lend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thanks have ye? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend hoping for nothing again, and your reward shall be great, and you shall be the children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. The man or the woman that has no mercy in their heart does not know the God of mercy. Jesus said, be ye therefore merciful as your Father also is merciful. Well, if God is merciful, his people should be likewise. If they are his children, they will. They will be merciful. So justice is not enough. That first requirement. Mercy must be loved and mercy must be shown to other people. That is so sadly lacking in our modern day society. Even as I stand here preaching about it, this grieves my heart to think how cruel and mean some people can be sometimes. There is no mercy whatsoever in their hearts toward any erring person or any person that is in the bond of iniquity and the gall of bitterness. Judgment without mercy is what they've got to look forward to, a very sad time out there in the future. Now we have seen the outward and the inward. The inward, you got mercy in your heart, see. The other one is the upward. You walk humbly with thy God. I know one man that did that. His name was Enoch. He walked with God, and he was not, for God took him home with him one afternoon. Remember what the old man said out in the country about it, whether it could be borne out by Scripture or not, I can't say. But it said they were out walking and talking one day, and said, oh, Enoch told the Lord, said, I think maybe I better go home. It's soon going to be sundown. He said, why, Enoch, said, come on and go home with me. Said, it's closer to my house from where we are and where it is to yours. Maybe a very simple thing, but it conveys a great truth, because he did take him home to the great house of God's people that very day. So what is it to walk humbly with thy God? A lot of people say, I walk with God. Do you walk humbly? Well, I walk very proudly. I'm proud to be a Baptist. I'm proud to be a Christian. I'm proud of my salvation. I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud to be an American. And on they go. Do you walk humbly with God? That's a requirement that many of us may come short on. It's not an easy thing to do. The flesh is against it. The world is against it. But God requires it of his people. So this is the right attitude toward God and a determination to walk in a continuous fellowship with him. In other words, to always be in communion and concord with God. Not getting out of fellowship like we sometimes do. The humble walk with God means that we recognize his holiness, righteousness, and sovereignty. And it is an indication that man has given up his will to the will and the purpose of God. You know that word to walk? That's a word of action. That's a word of movement and activity. To walk is to live and act according to what you know to be so about God. In other words, it's to live and act as seen in the case of Enoch. He lived and acted as if he were in the presence of God at all times. So to walk with God is to devote ourselves to his service, to make his glory our great object and the very end of our life. It is to value nothing more than his favor and to fear his displeasure. It is to do all that we do with the thought that he may approve of our conduct. I think about how the Apostle Paul said, we labor that we may be accepted of him. Told the Corinthians that. Not that the church may approve it, or the world may approve it, or even our own conscience approve it, but we labor to be accepted of him. Whether we live or whether we die, he said, it must be so. And so the person that walks humbly with God, he doesn't really care whether the world approves of his conduct or not. I mean, he couldn't care less. His only concern is that he remains in communion and concord with God. If God approves of it, he doesn't care whether man approves or disapproves. So many times in this modern world, you know, people say, well, you know, I don't want to offend nobody. I don't want people to talk bad about me. So I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. What difference does it make? Does God approve or disapprove of it? That's the issue. If God approves of it, well and good. If he disapproves of it, all men approve of it, it's still wrong. And you ought not to do it. Because it is his approval that we must be always seeking. I think sometimes it's easy to talk about justice and talk about mercy. But it's very hard to walk humbly with God. Few people do it in this world. I want to say a few other things here. Salvation is really the soul going away from sin and the world to God. We call it repentance sometimes. We call it conversion. All amounts to the same thing. You change your mind about sin and the world, and you move toward God. You turn to God. That's conversion. That's repentance. But salvation is going to God and living before God, serving God, and doing what God approves of. It's not merely going to temples or theologies or ceremonies that the Lord's concerned about. It is going to God. That's where the taproot must be. There must be true life that is in relation to God and man. If we do not live justly before men and we do not walk humbly with God, what difference does it make? We're a very poor excuse for a Christian. I sometimes wonder if the Pharisees still live. Somebody said, well, that old sect of Judaism pretty well died out a long time ago. I'm not so sure about that. You know what their problem was? They put all the stress on the letter, none on the spirit. They were concerned about little old minor theological things. They They made non-essentials to be very essential sometimes. But the weightier matters of the law didn't mean a thing to them. To do justly, to walk humbly with God, meant nothing whatsoever to them. Listen to what Christ condemned them for there in Matthew 23:23. And then ask yourself the question, do the Pharisees still live? One to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Didn't call them too good a name, did he? For you pay tithes of mint and anise and cumin. In other words, you tithe the very vegetables out of your garden. You give the Lord one turnip out of the ten. Put it in modern terminology, one ear of corn out of ten and one bowl of beans for 10 bowls of beans, and so on, I could go with it. They were tithing things out of their garden there. That's what it's referring to. Herbs out of the garden. Dill was one of them, to put it in modern terminology. The anise is dill. That's garden herbs. You use them to flavor food and the like. For ye pay tithes of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law. There are certain things in the law that are more weighty than others. You can argue about it if you want to. Say, well, stealing the pen is bad as stealing $1 million. Well, you could argue that point, but there are some weightier matters of the law. The Bible said so. What are the weightier matters of the law? What are the real important things? Judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, they had been unjust, and they had shown no mercy toward publicans and sinners, and they had no faith in the Messiah. And yet they thought they were carrying out everything that God required of them. How pitiful. Judgment, mercy, and faith. These ye ought to have done. In other words, you ought to pay your tithes and all of that, and not to leave the others undone. Some understand that vice versa, but it still amounts to the same. He commended them for what they had done in the way of tithing. And he said, you ought not to have omitted though judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, I think this is one of the greatest verses in the book of Micah. I think it gives a summation of the entire true religion that God requires of his people. I want to read it again. I want you to listen to it very carefully. And carry it home and think about it this next week. He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? It doesn't take a great theologian to understand those verses, but it takes a lot of the grace of God to obey them and carry them out like the Lord requires of his people. Let us stand, and we shall sing.